extent that they did. None of us who lived through these events, which is basically all of us, everybody listening.
And we leave it right there. That was the Gary Null Show that is heard Monday through Friday at noon here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. And now stay tuned for Leonard Lopate at Large. It is now 1 p.m. Stay tuned.
I'm Leonard Lopate. A new book titled White Power and American Neoliberal Culture argues that white extremist worldviews and the violence they provoke have converged with a radical economic and social agenda to shape daily life in the United States. Its authors, Patricia Ventura and Edward K. Chan, analyze the conjunction of current forms of white supremacy and racial capitalism. The book is published by the University of California Press and brings Patricia Ventura and Edward K. Chan to our show now. Welcome.
Thank you.
Hello, thank you.
Okay, well, initially I'll address each of you, but as we go on, jump in when you think that you have the best answer. Patricia, you begin your book by stating that it began as a tongue-in-cheek discussion in 2009 about what?
Well, actually, yeah, Ed and I were at a conference talking about really depressing subjects because it was, you know, we were in the middle of those Trump years, and we were at this conference just talking about the kind of white power utopias that we talk about in the book, where the white power people, the white power activists are, you know, imagining what their perfect world is. And as we keep talking about it and imagining where Trump's role in that perfect world that these white, from the white power perspective, what their utopias look like, we began to think, hey, you know, there's something we can talk about here with this figure, Donald Trump, who's so associated with, you know, so many things that supposedly these white power people don't like in terms of their economic worldviews or their views. You know, like his daughter and son-in-law are Jewish and they're famously anti-Semitic. All these combinations of unexpected connections, we began talking about it, and that's where we began thinking about this book.
But aren't you arguing here that the issues involved are much larger than any one individual, not just Donald Trump?
Absolutely, 100%. These are issues of deep global significance. We're looking at the U.S. scene, but they are definitely issues that affect so much of life in the United States, certainly, but around many parts of the world, or much of the world as well. Absolutely.
And we'll try to get to that as this conversation proceeds. Edward, isn't the term neoliberal confusing? Perhaps we should begin by defining it. How is it different from neoconservative?
It's a great question. I'm actually going to defer this to Trish because she's the neoliberal person. One thing I'll just sort of say as this project came together is, I mostly study like utopian literature, race and utopian literature, and Trish has written in the past about neoliberal American culture. And one of the things we found as we were talking about these things is that we were able to like sort of see some overlap between these two fields. But Trish, why don't you go ahead with your take on neoliberalism?
Yeah, because the word liberal usually suggests something on the left, and you're talking about people on the right.
That's right. Yeah, because what we're talking about is this way in which the self really is defined through the economic sphere, such that neoliberalism famously is this kind of, especially when we're talking about it as a culture, which is the way we like to talk, the way we talk about it in our work, because we're coming at this as cultural studies people. We talk about the American neoliberal culture as this kind of everyday environment shaped by capitalist economic approaches favoring market fundamentalism, deregulation, et cetera. But what it does is it makes in all of us as individuals feel like we have to be entrepreneurs of ourselves, almost like we're market, you know, products, that we have to be our own brands, as they always say. And so that puts us in this position of seeing ourselves as part of that economy, as products themselves. And so that worldview shapes so much of contemporary life today, we would argue.
Well, white power and neoliberalism are seemingly separate forces. Do they enable each other?
Well, that's one of the arguments that we want to make here, is that very surprisingly that they do seem to supercharge each other. And, you know, we think about white power and neoliberalism not as the same thing, certainly not, but that if you think of this kind of Venn diagram, there's certain areas of overlap. And we try to focus on those areas of overlap. And especially what we realize is that a lot of that has to do with the family, that the family is the area of overlap for these two, what are very different forces, absolutely.
Well, on its most basic level, isn't neoliberalism, doesn't it reject the idea of society and social obligation?
Absolutely. That seems to be at the core of so much of the energies that are today really of people who are feeling really lost, I think, is that sense of feeling disconnected, of feeling more isolated than ever, of feeling that, you know, they don't have the support of certainly not of the welfare state the way that they do in most other industrialized nations. So that sense of not having social obligations really shapes so much of the politics today, so much of the actual, you know, sadness that we see in the world, too, I would argue.
And you're talking about what you call an alarming growth of both white ethno-nationalist authoritarianism as well as extreme violence that is perpetrated within the ideas of white power ideology.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So, Edward, is something similar happening in other parts of the world?
I think so. I mean, definitely in Europe. You know, you have the very famous Breivik stuff happening in Norway, and other places.
Viktor
as well.
Orban.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, both Trish and I are Americanists, basically, so we concentrate on the U.S. But certainly this has taught, and I mean, and both, you know, neoliberalism and white power are very much global formations. There are direct ties in, like, white power that connect people in the U.S. to, like, people like Tip Brend, Tarrant in New Zealand and Australia, et cetera, et cetera.
And don't we see something similar in India with Narendra Modi and the way he has divided the country?
Yeah. I mean, there definitely is talk about that. And like any of these kinds of like nationalisms that are based on a kind of ethnic identity, I think definitely feed into this. So even though it's not like white supremacy or whatever, it still is a kind of ethno-nationalism.
I throw this out to both of you. You say in the book that you see American neoliberal culture as having taken root as a reaction against the social movement activism of the civil rights Vietnam anti-colonialism era. And in the U.S., you see it coming to fruition with the end of the Cold War in 1989, lasting through our present time. Has it been getting worse? Is it very common today?
You're talking about the white power activism, is it common today? And certainly, I mean, certainly we see it. Think about what's happening in terms of everyday discourse. I mean, the idea that nowadays you could say some words like accelerationism Or you could say words like great replacement. And people know what that is that are not in those, you know, white power circles, because in news media, I mean, Tucker Carlson, right? This is famously talking about great replacement theory, conspiracy theory. So this is a real change in recent years.
Would you call it racial capitalism?
Well, we do talk about racial capitalism as absolutely essential here. I mean, we could argue that capitalism has always been racial capitalism, that capitalism has depended on having these kind of racialized categories that very much connect to the kinds of people that can be, you know, the owners of capital and the kind of people who are the workers within that regime. Yeah.
Where does anti-Semitism come into this story?
Go ahead, Trish.
It
plays absolutely a big part, especially in the white power movement. And the racialization of Jewish people is a core element to that. And, maybe even one of the biggest targets. And especially the kind of demonization of Jewish people as these like kind of masters behind the scenes, kind of controlling things. They're kind of the ultimate capitalists. But the irony, right, is that, even though capitalism and, white power are really don't go together, fit together well, there's a way that they actually do. And that's through, this like kind of focus on this idealized nuclear hetero patriarchal family.
Now, you're talking to us from Tokyo?
That's right, yeah, where it's 2 o'clock in the morning.
Well, I hope this isn't going to put you to sleep, this conversation.
I'll try to stay awake.
Now, do we see anything like that? Well, I mentioned Modi in India. Almost every country has groups that are come out of different consciousnesses, something like that in Japan as well?
There certainly is, there are ultranationalists here. And I do think it's tied to a kind of concept of racial identity. That movement is still like very much minor and on the fringe here. It hasn't like that kind of stuff hasn't really penetrated, I think, into the mainstream as much as it has in the U.S. and other places around the world, like India and in Europe as well. So, it also gets complicated because the way race works in Japan is a little bit different than it does in the U.S. and other Western countries.
Or even in China.
Exactly. Right. That's right. Yeah.
My guests on today's Leonard Lopate at Large are Edward K. Chan and Patricia Ventura. Their book, their latest collaboration, is White Power and American Neoliberal Culture, published by the University of California Press. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and streaming live at WBAI.org. You've come up with the term far white to describe the spectrum of white identity, politics, and ideologies. Is that how Trump's followers interpreted his promise to make America great again?
Well, I mean, we were thinking of this far white as a category that might be more specific even than the MAGA, I mean, a part of MAGA, the kind of those people who endorse political violence, but are not necessarily part of any kind of white nationalist organization, but they still endorse political violence. So, I mean, really January 6th to me exemplifies that kind of far whiteness that we're addressing.
Well, didn't Trump open his presidential campaign by calling Mexican immigrants rapists? Was that an alert to people who have racist attitudes?
I mean, there is no question that Trump understood there's a specific audience out there that was not being addressed by dominant political discourse in that same, you know, very direct way. And they were clearly yearning for it. You know, they were yearning for someone who would speak that language very directly and use less of the dog whistles that we've come to associate with so much of that kind of, that same kind of discourse. You know, you think back, you know, the dog whistle might be something like, you know, a welfare queen is a classic dog whistle, but something like Mexicans are rapists. I mean, there's no whistle. That's just blunt, right? That's just the statement. And so he absolutely understood there was an audience out there for this kind of message.
And we had just come off of two terms by our first black president.
That's exactly right. That's not a coincidence. I mean, that moment, that 2008 moment really worked as, you know, an alarm bell to these kinds of far white and other groups like that, other, you know, groupings of people like that. Yeah, absolutely. And so you figured that those two terms of Barack Obama, Trump is that kind of reactionary response to
the alternative. But Barack Obama didn't play racial politics very heavily.
No, I would say he did not in that same way. But I mean, it doesn't matter because, you know, we have a quotation from David Duke to the effect of the former Klan, you know, leader, to the effect that he was a walking billboard for white supremacist ideologies, because they see him and then they're terrified and they want something different. So he didn't even have to talk about race specifically or explicitly.
But once we have one black president, we may very well start having more.
Right. It just opens up the door. Right. And there was an uptick in white power extremist violence after the election of Obama. And, you know, it hasn't gone to the extent that it has now. But so, and again, Trump, and I don't want to focus too much attention on Trump, but I mean, he did sort of enable, like, sort of all of this stuff to come out of the woodwork, certainly.
Well, weren't white power activists among the most violent activists in the January 6th insurrection?
Absolutely. Yeah. And then, and many others, right? And many of the other shootings. So, you know, it's kind of depressing, but we felt like we had to go through a catalog of all these mass shootings that involved people who had some kind of tie to a kind of white power ideology. And it's of course horrible, but we just felt it was something that had to be done. And unfortunately, it's still going on, of course.
Well, Hitler and Nazism were the enemy during World War II. We were very proud of the fact that we won that war. And yet, any number of these people carry swastika flags, or we just heard about somebody who had a shooter who had swastika tattoos.
That's right, yeah. And, you know, so this kind of neo-Nazism isn't, like, the white power movement isn't just neo-Nazis, but certainly neo-Nazis are a part of it in our conception of it.
Some of the white power people might reject Nazism. And others,
or might not identify as like Nazis, right? Yeah, but they still identify with some kind of white supremacy or white separatism or whatever they might want to call it. So that's, you know, the terminology, of course, gets very confusing, and that's one of the reasons we use the term white power. And, you know, we're of course not the first people to do that, but there's like white supremacy, white nationalism, you know, white extremists, like, and so how do we talk about all these different kinds of activities and ways of thinking. And to some degree, I mean, white power just is a convenient way to talk about this, like, kind of current moment that, you know, goes back, I would say, to the 60s. and George Lincoln Rockwell, who was the founder of the American Nazi Party, you know, he had a manifesto kind of called White Power that was a response to Black Power and a response in general to this kind of perception that non-white people were starting to take over America.
But don't you make a distinction in this book between white power and white privilege?
Yeah, definitely. I think, I mean, you know, white privilege. So white, when we say white power, we're, I think we're really talking about groups that are very actively trying to engage in violence, start race wars, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, whereas white privilege is just this kind of thing that's built, this like institutional structural racism that's built into American society. So, yeah, I think they're very different things. Yeah.
How do the mass shootings that have become almost daily news fit into this picture?
Trish, you want to take this one?
Well, I mean, they fit in the ways in which the there's so many ways. There's certainly
well, in terms race of the, is often a factor in the shootings.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, so that would be one, you know, one obvious way is that racialized component, whether it's people, you know, regardless of who they're targeting, right? So in some cases they're targeting, you know, you'll hear of synagogues being targeted. In some case you'll hear of a Walmart where a lot of Latin people shop, or you'll hear, you know, I mean, it depends on which group is being targeted, but they all fall under the same kind of umbrella. But there's a also a larger just general cultural instability because of the system. I mean, in because of a lot of things, but in part because of the economic instabilities as well. So you have the kind of wild oscillations that are really some of the hallmarks of the neoliberal economic picture. You know, if you think about it in contrast to the New Deal, post-Great Depression, you know, the so-called, you know, those big state programs that have been, that are really popular, like Social Security, for instance, like Medicare, for instance, you know, these are programs that create more stability. And the more these social programs get eroded, the more instability there is in the general, you know, cultural milieu of the United States. And so the more instability, the more there is this opportunity, you know, for people to feel disaffected. I mean, there's so much that is going on. There's so many different factors here, but you see this combination of instability in generally with also this fear of, you know, whiteness not having the same kind of cultural capital it might have had at one point, in part related to our earlier conversation about Barack Obama and just other, you know, the presence of multiple pluralistic cultures, you know, in the United States.
You cite a sense of aggrieved entitlement.
Yeah.
I'm using your phrase.
And actually, this is a phrase from other scholars. It's not really our phrase per se. It's a phrase that you see in a lot of the scholarship about this area.
Like white rage, white fragility, even to some degree. And all of this like sort of ties into like a larger perception of these fears of that. In its extreme form, become fears of like white replacement and all that kind of stuff.
So do neoliberals argue that people are inherently unequal and in need of hierarchy?
Absolutely. It's very much and very friendly to autocrats, to authoritarianism. You know, I mean, you think about the classic case of Chile, right, and Pinochet. That was an authoritarian regime that was very much tied in with neoliberal forces. And so, you know, that's been famously discussed by a lot of people before us, certainly. But those kinds of movements are, because what happens is that, that these authoritarian or autocratic leaders, okay, also think about Putin, you know, I mean, these, think about these leaders, they enable a certain kind of fluidity of financial capitalism. They may stop people. They don't want immigrants, but they're happy to have money pouring in and their money to go out, their you know, their capital to go out into foreign banks for their personal enrichment. So they serve certainly these larger economic forces happily.
Well, since these terms get all a bit confusing, do they see themselves as defenders of democracy?
No, no. I said that very vehemently, didn't I? No, they do not.
So democracy doesn't apply to matters of race and sexuality.
And also, they would like it to not apply to matters of the economy so much either, you know?
So white people should have most of the money, is that it? It often works out that way anyway, doesn't it?
Indeed, yeah. You know, it's, and I think one of the important things that we're trying to like do here is bring together discussions and analyses of economics and capitalism and things like that with the analysis of race and things like white power, and that we need to think about both of these things together because, you know, certainly we've done a lot of thinking, people have done a lot of thinking about the problem of white extremism and the problems of capitalism, but bringing them together is, we think, crucial in order to understand what really is happening in some of the ways we've already been talking about, the incidences of mass shootings and such, and also the way that everyone is feeling, and you know, it doesn't matter what race we're talking about, everyone is sort of, you know, suffering from the immiseration of capitalism.
Well, why have LGBTQ people come to be seen as a threat? It doesn't matter whether they're white or not, right?
Yeah, I mean, because they're very much a threat to they actually are a threat to whiteness in the sense that they are antithetical to the traditional nuclear family, right? So, and you know, one of the famous things in white power, one of the famous slogans is David Blaine's 14 words. So we must secure the existence of our people and a future for white children, right? So that's become a mantra. And even just the numerals 14 has become a sign that you're, you know, part of this kind of white power ideology. And so LGBTQ plus people are a threat to the reproduction of the white race. And therefore, they also are targets, as in the same way that non-white people are.
Reproduction as they want to see it, as, you know, male-dominated families, women, you know, pushing out babies. I mean, very, very specific.
So men and women are not equal, Patricia?
Not in their worldview.
And how does that apply to the recent fight over reproductive rights?
I mean, we are, yeah. Oh, Ed, do you want to address that?
Oh, well, if you have something, go ahead. But I was just going to say that, yeah, I mean, the fight over the reproductive rights, I think, is, again, a symptom of this, like, kind of perception that the family is being, you know, sort of attacked. So if we allow abortion, then it's decimating the family, and then for white power people, it's also decimating the white race because it's not allowing for the reproduction.
You want to add to that, Patricia?
Well, just that I think that when you have women having autonomy over reproduction, or a certain level of autonomy, you know, that is a threat when you only see women's roles as to reproduce when you think they should. So it's a threat to the that perspective on multiple levels.
You're listening to Leonard Lopate at Large on WBAI New York 99.5 FM and streaming live at WBAI.org. I hope you're enjoying my conversation with Patricia Ventura and Edward K. Chan. If you sign up to become a member of WBAI during today's show with a contribution of $50 or more, you can receive a free copy of the book we've been discussing, White Power and American Neoliberal Culture. To do that, just go online to give to WBAI.org. Let's give and the number 2. WBAI.org or call 212-209-2950. That's 212-209-2950. Do that during today's show and we'll be happy to send you a copy. But don't forget to make that $50 donation in the name of Leonard Lopate at Large. And we thank you very much. And return to our guests, Patricia Ventura, Edward K. Chan, their book, White Power and American Neoliberal Culture, published by the University of California Press. Patricia Ventura is an associate professor of English at Spelman College in Atlanta. Edward Chan is a professor of American Studies at Waseda University in Tokyo. And are people, your students, studying things like this in Tokyo, Professor Chan?
Unfortunately, they're not. Yeah, you know, it's interesting because the way that race is talked about, well, race, I think, is not really talked about so much as it is in U.S. academic institutions as it is in Japan. So to be honest, I mean, since, you know, most of my work is really on the literature of that deals with this white power stuff. I hesitate to subject my students to having to read this stuff because it really is not pleasant or enjoyable in any way. But certainly they need to know about what's happening.
Well, a listener just wrote, ask about CRT banning books, banning speech, drag.
Yes. I mean, that is this moment of this post-Trump moment when, you know, he lost the election, right? I don't want to say post-Trump, I meant post-Trump presidency, because he lost the election, but obviously he's still looming. But when he lost that election, the forces that energized MAGA certainly needed another way to talk about the issues they want to talk about. CRT became a convenient way to a container, let's say, for those kinds of discussions that Trump was having that clearly enough American people didn't want to have that, you know, he lost and many of his candidates have lost. So CRT becomes a new way to talk about these issues. And banning the books, I mean, it's right there with it, because you're talking about, when I say talking about these issues, I probably should say not talking about the issues that we're talking about, because that's the whole point, right? That they don't want to address racism. So talking about these issues, meaning seeing the white people as victims again, right? So they don't have CRT, quote unquote, because that upsets too many children, is the rationale for the anti-CRT discourse that you see in the banned books. Oh, that upsets too many children if you talk about slavery or racism. So let's not talk about it. They're too young. I mean, you hear these just this kind of rationale.
They'll be upset.
They'll be upset.
And this, I think that, you know, these initiatives also show that, I mean, it's not even really about Trump. I mean, Trump was really just a figurehead for a larger, like, sort of groundswell of feeling across the country against, well, for some kind of reconsolidation of whiteness and white identity.
And why has it become a Democrats versus Republican thing in the history of this country? For a long time, the Democrats were the Southern Democrats argued many of these points. And even as recently as Bill Clinton, we had the Southern strategy. So is it a bit more complicated than simply Republicans seeing it, or some Republicans anyway, seeing it one way and Democrats another?
Yeah, the Southern strategy really, I mean, famously, right, was created as a way to get these voters who had been solidly Democratic post-Civil War to switch over. So it was the same.
To come back to the Democratic Party. Yeah.
Southern strategy was, yeah, attempt to get them to be Republicans, to leave the Democratic Party, to become Republicans. Because that, you know, after the Civil War, and I know it sounds like that's ancient history in some ways, but no, it's not. But after the Civil War, they became solidly Democrats because obviously, right, Lincoln was a Republican. So that the solid South was Democratic throughout, you know, much of post-Civil War history until that moment in the basically Nixon moment was when you see the birth of the Southern strategy. There had been, you know, various moments of going back to Southerners voting for Democrats, like Jimmy Carter the first time he ran. But by and large, right, you've seen that's been the shift since the Nixon era.
And Southern Democrats like George Wallace then switched parties.
Exactly. That's right. Yeah. Switch parties. You know, you had other people doing that before that, you know, Strom Thurmond before that. But that major movement through was post-68 and post-68, I should say.
You write that the Turner Diaries by William Luther Pierce was the most influential white power novel. When was it published?
God, I forgot, actually. Let's see. It's 1970s.
1978, I know.
Okay. 1970, okay. Yeah.
Recently, actually, considering what it's about.
Yeah. And very prescient in a lot of ways as well. And, of course, it's become a source book, unfortunately, for a lot of white power extremists. But Pierce had been around in the movement. He was originally a neo-Nazi. He was part of the American Nazi Party. He followed George Lincoln Rockwell. And so there's a whole lineage that goes back, you know, certainly at least until the 1960s and Rockwell. But we also are, I think, trying to say that what we're seeing today and what we're calling white power is just the newest, like, sort of formation of a kind of white, larger, like, kind of white supremacy that goes back to the very beginning of the country. There are like echoes of earlier formations of white supremacy, whether it be the KKK or whatever. But the Turner Diaries, for whatever reason, has become the book that everyone turns to.
In it, all groups opposed to Earl Turner, the novel's protagonist, including Jews, non-whites, liberal actors, and politicians, are murdered.
That's right, and sometimes hanged, right? And women, you know, women, white women who have had, interracial relations are strung up and hung with signs that say, "I defiled my race," or something like that. It's pretty horrible.
I mean, take it to January 6th. Some people, in response to the January 6th events, were saying Day of the Rope. And Day of the Rope is a very classic figure from the Turner Diaries of the day when people were, you know, hanged for their interracial relations. So this that book stands as a kind of a hallmark for sure.
Well, considering the fact that we're talking about something, a movement that's also very patriarchal, are you surprised by how many women are in this movement and how we even wind up with a couple of, well, more than a couple, any number of women in American politics who would pretty much subscribe to all of these things, not just Marjorie Taylor Greene?
Yeah, that's, I think, part of the power of this ideology that even though it has this patriarchal like kind of worldview, it's still powerful enough to draw women in, and as long as, you know, they know their place. And in these kind of white power movements in general, you know, women have, you know, there have been a lot of women involved in it, and like sociologists have studied this. And I think part of the attraction is that this kind of white power worldview gives them a place and a secure, stable identity in this, in a world that, you know, mostly is chaotic and doesn't make sense. So, you know, even if they have to take a lower place, let's say, than the white male, they still have, you know, something to live for and an importance and a purpose in the world.
You want to add to that, Patricia? Or, well, let me tell the audience that my guests are Edward K. Chan and Patricia Ventura. Their latest book, White Power and American Neoliberal Culture, published by the University of California Press. This is WBAI. New York, 99.5 FM, and streaming live at WBAI.org. You wrote this book using sources like White Terrorist Manifestos, White Power Utopian Fiction, Neoliberal Think Tank Reports, and Neoconservative Policy Statements. Are these things all easily available?
The manifestos are now hard to come by. And, you know, it's understandable that there's been an effort to, like, not have them proliferate. But, you know, certainly they can still be found, unfortunately. While I understand the desire to not, like, have them so easily available, at the same time, I do think that we really need to be looking at them and trying to understand them. And even when they're filled with, you know, I forget the term, but, you know, like it, when they're ironic and not even really being serious and just trolling, they, you know, we still need to understand, like, kind of what's coming out of these, and then how those ideas then relate to other things like neoliberal think tank reports and stuff like that. But yeah, it is hard to get. And even the novels, like some of the novels that we've talked about in the book, are no longer available, you know, like on Amazon or whatever. And again, I have mixed feelings about that because, you know, I'm glad that, you know, not many people are reading it, but at the same time, I feel like we need to be reading them to sort of understand them.
You mentioned Vladimir Putin earlier. Why has he become something of a hero to many of the neoliberals?
There's so many of these figures like that, you know, and Orban too, right? That love affair with Orban that you hear so much about. And you know, these are people who are proudly anti-immigrant, proudly anti-Islam, you know. They have done actions that can be seen in racialized terms. And of course, they're famously very white associated, very white identified. And they don't run away from those kinds of labels, even though race tends to mean different things in different places. Nevertheless, there is still a Eurocentrism, let's say, that these figures don't seem to want to run away from, that they embrace. And so figures like Putin, and they're also very autocratic, right? So there's that strong patriarch. They're very they're homophobic. They're anti-gay rights, very, very explicitly, very pro-patriarchy, very explicitly so. So these kinds of positions may endear them, you know, to a certain kind of right-wing personality.
And then also to the white power people as well. Like, so one of the novels we analyze is called KD Rebel by David Lane, who had a very storied career and who coined the 14 words that is now a mantra. In that novel, there's this like kind of gesture towards like Russia as like gonna, as the like kind of place that is going to save the white race. Like, you know, it's going to participate in that.
Russia is going to save the white race?
Yeah.
So
well,
does that
mean
that the people they're killing in Ukraine are not white?
I don't think it's referring to that necessarily, but I mean, just that there's a spark of hope for the white people in America who have been like, you know, smashed down by multiculturalism and things like that. They can look to like a place like Russia as where, you know, whiteness will like kind of rise again. And then will, you know, sort of help the white people in the U.S.
I guess that's why conservatives are called reds now in this country. You should be liberals with the reds.
I, you know, I'm old enough to still be shocked by that, to be honest.
Now, this isn't your first collaboration. How did you, the two of you, come to work together? and at such a great distance, Edward in Tokyo and Patricia, you're mostly in Atlanta.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we meet up at conferences often because we're in the same kinds of groups professionally. But the internet. The internet's our friend, you know, in this regard. And so we do communicate that way a lot. But we met as through mutual friends and just stayed buddies over the years, you know. And the collaboration is interesting because I don't know how Ed feels, but I feel like we both don't have a ton of ego. So when the other one says, yeah, that's no good, don't include that, you know, we'll just take it out. So that helps the writing go a lot smoother.
It does, yeah, absolutely. And I actually used to live in Atlanta, and I taught at a university there for a number of years. And so we were there at about the same time before I decided to come to Japan.
I wonder if we're going to see more and more of this, people writing at a distance using the internet.
Yeah, it's an interesting development. It's you know, with things like file sharing over like Google Docs or whatever, I mean, it's very easy to like collaborate on writing projects. So yeah, I mean, and of course we have to deal with the time delay. Like Tokyo is 13 hours ahead of the East Coast there in the U.S., but it works out.
Now, I think we've covered a lot of territory, but I suspect there are some things that you wish we had also addressed. We have about 2 or 3 minutes left. Do you want to talk about any of those things?
Well, I guess one thing I wanted to mention is that this goes back to your point about the Democrat-Republican split. I mean, we should, I think, keep in mind that neoliberalism is not something that's just like Republican. Democrats are also very much implicated in the whole formation of neoliberalism as well. So, you know, Clinton, even Obama and others as well. So, yeah,
Obama
it doesn't come down
neoliberal?
To
neoliberal
like
in what way?
I'm sorry, I didn't
How was
that.
Obama neoliberal? Although I'm sure people who tune in late and don't know the term are wondering, wait, aren't neoliberals new leftists?
Yeah, they're definitely not new leftists. Yeah.
We're using liberal in the old sense from the 19th century, right?
Right. The tradition of liberalism, right, as a political ideology of like freedom and
keep government out of our lives.
Exactly. Yeah. And so, I mean, I don't mean to like call out Obama as like a evil person, but I mean, you know, but I think it's true that not just him, the Democratic Party as well, participates in the perpetuation of a neoliberal capitalism. I mean, so that's all I'm really trying to say. So that's it. So Trish, I don't know if you have anything.
Yay, team. I think we've covered so much territory today in this interview. And I mean, that's what the book is about, right? It is covering a lot of territory by putting together these two forces that don't often get put together. But again, we argue that it's that view of the family, that white, patriarchal, you know, women reproducing and all the time just having lots of babies and the men out there working. That perspective is at the core really of both of these formations, as we call them, you know, because one, the white power one, we know is because they're trying to reproduce whiteness. But with neoliberalism, it's that the forces of neoliberalism want to make the social state smaller, erode it. And so who then takes over those caring functions, the support for people in need? Well, you give it back to the family where they are, you know, where no one's getting paid really to do this work. And so and you can then slash taxes, you can then get the rich to become even richer. And that movement is at the core, that family is at the core of what we see as kind of like that Venn diagram between white power and neoliberalism.
Well, there are certain areas of the country that have more white power populations than others?
It's interesting. Sure, there are places.
You would assume the South, but it seems to me that as I watch other states go from left to right and right to left, that we are in a constant transition.
Yeah, and certainly the white power folks are all over, and there's a whole like kind of mythology about creating the Northwest, the Pacific Northwest, as this new white nation, like separated from the rest of the United States. So Idaho, Idaho and Montana have long had a lot of ties to those kinds of groups, but certainly they're spread all over. So we see these things happening in Texas and Philadelphia and Pennsylvania, et cetera.
And Ohio has changed. My great thanks to both of you for a fascinating conversation. My guests have been Patricia Ventura and Edward K. Chan. Their book, White Power and American Neoliberal Culture, published by the University of California Press. Patricia Ventura is Associate Professor of English at Spelman College in Atlanta, and Edward K. Chan is Professor of American Studies at Waseda University in Tokyo. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us. This has been great fun. Thank you so much. Maybe less fun for Ed because it's 3 a.m.
I'm going to sleep now. But thank you very much.
Pleasant dreams. Don't let the fear of white power keep you awake. And that brings us to the end of our show. My great thanks to Keziah Glow, our executive producer, and Reggie Johnson, our audio engineer, for all of the invaluable work they do throughout the week. If you're just discovering this program and would like to hear more of our one-hour deep dive interviews, you can access our over 800 past shows streaming on demand at WBAI.org. Our podcast, which has surpassed 1 million plays, is available on iTunes, Apple, and wherever else you get your podcasts. And if you'd like to write to me, my email address is leonardlopate@wbai.org. Before I sign up today, I need to ask you to support WBAI to keep this station coming to you and the show coming to you weekdays from 1 to 2 p.m. We're asking all of our listeners who have the means to do so to make a contribution at whatever level they're comfortable with by calling 212-209-2950 or by going online to give to WBAI.org right now. That's give and the number 2, WBAI.org. Because we need your help to keep bringing you this unique in-depth content, information you usually don't get anywhere else. And as I mentioned earlier, anyone who makes a contribution of $50 or more in the name of Leonard Lopate at Large right now can receive a copy of the book we've been discussing, White Power and American Neoliberal Culture, by Patricia Ventura and Edward K. Chan. So why not make that call right now, 212 209-2950 or go online to give2wbai.org. And you might also consider becoming a sustaining member, what we call a BAI buddy, for $10, $15, $20, $25 a month. And that allows us to plan for the future. And we will say thank you if you do that for $10 a month or more by sending you a WBAI tote bag. But either way, I hope you'll call right now, because WBAI is the only station in New York Radio Dallas that's 100% listener sponsored. Please keep us alive and thriving with your tax-deductible support. Our show will be off parts of next week, but tune in and find out when we're here. Have a great weekend.
WPFW in Washington and WBAI New York. I'm Chris Bengert-Drowns with some brief news headlines. The Biden administration today proposed new limits on greenhouse gas emissions from coal and gas-fired power plants, its most ambitious effort yet to confront the climate crisis. The new rule from the EPA would impose increased carbon pollution standards and new restrictions on coal and natural gas power plants. If finalized, the proposed regulation would mark the first time the federal government has restricted carbon dioxide emissions from existing power plants, which generate about 25% of U.S. greenhouse gas pollution, second only to the transportation sector. The National Mining Association, a lobby group for coal and hard rock mining companies, preemptively criticized the rule yesterday, and more pushback is expected from the fossil fuel industry. Republican Representative George Santos, who had lied about several aspects of his personal and professional history while running for office, was arrested on federal criminal charges yesterday. Appearing in court in Long Island, Santos pleaded not guilty to the 13 counts against him. The indictment accuses Santos of using campaign donations for personal expenses, including luxury clothes and credit card payments. Santos was released on $500,000 bail following the arraignment hearing. Media reports over the past several months showed that Santos had lied about his ethnic ancestry, educational experience, work history, and financial success, among other topics. Many fellow lawmakers, including Republicans, have called on him to resign, but he has refused. Santos faces up to 20 years in prison and will appear in court again on June 30th. The policy known as Title 42 will expire just before midnight tonight. Over the past 3 years, the policy was used nearly 3 million times to turn back asylum seekers at the U.S. southern border. Hoping to prevent a wave of illegal border crossings, the Department of Justice is implementing new rules today that are intended to make it more difficult for migrants to seek asylum. Among other provisions, the new policy will deny asylum to migrants who show up at the Mexico border without first seeking protection in a country they passed through. Responding to the rule, the American Immigration Council said that instead of forcing asylum seekers to seek protection in third-party countries, quote, the Biden administration and Congress should work together to create a flexible and orderly asylum system, which will reduce unjust outcomes and incentivize regular migration, end quote. And Ukraine is set to receive long-range cruise missiles from the United Kingdom, the first country to commit to sending such weapons, which have been coveted by Ukrainian leadership. British Defense Secretary Ben Wallace made the announcement to UK lawmakers earlier today, saying the missiles, quote, are now going into or are in the country itself, end quote. The so-called Storm Shadow missiles have a range of more than 155 miles, giving Ukrainian forces the ability to strike far behind the front line, including into Crimea. The new weapons shipment comes ahead of a highly anticipated counteroffensive by Ukraine. President Zelensky told BBC in an interview broadcast today that the counteroffensive needs, quote, a bit more time, and said Ukraine was waiting on further equipment. Weather in Washington, D.C. right now is 73 degrees and mostly cloudy. In New York City, 76 degrees with fair skies. For WPFW in Washington and W.